Every book in the Bible was written for a specific reason, and especially with Paul being the majority writer of the epistles of the New Testament, it's interesting to look at the kind of focus issues that he deals with in each different book that he writes. And of course, that's true for the other authors too besides Paul. I mean, they all had something that they really wanted to say. The four Gospels were written by four different authors, and yet they present the same Jesus, but they present him from a perspective that is uniquely theirs in terms of how they perceive him as the solution to the issues of life that they've had to face. And then, of course, Luke, after he wrote his Gospel, he wrote the book of Acts, and that was a record, basically, of how the Word of God spread. And Luke was Paul's physician, so he was with him a lot. And then with all of the New Testament epistles, you can see different emphases except in the book of Romans, because the book of Romans is a, he calls it the gospel of God, but it's the only letter that he wrote to a group of people that he'd never been to see. He wrote it to the church in Rome and before he ever got to Rome. So he didn't know what they had been taught. He only knew they were there, that there was a church in Rome, and he wrote this letter of Romans to cover all the bases in seed form. I mean, he didn't deal with all of the issues with the depth that he did in the individual letters, but he wanted to make sure that the Romans had a good comprehensive theological foundation. And in the letter to the Thessalonians, the two letters, the focus is on the issue of Jesus coming for us and how we're supposed to relate to that particular truth. From my studies, the book of Galatians was probably the first letter that Paul ever wrote, and he wrote that shortly after they had the church council in 49 AD. And that council was basically called because the gospel in Jerusalem had never been separated out from some of its distortions that came along with Judaism. I mean, you hear the gospel, but you don't just forsake everything you've ever learned. So the latent legalism that was built into Jewish theology and thinking was not solved by the experience of salvation and faith in the grace of God. So Paul had to go to Jerusalem. He says in Galatians that God told him to go and to straighten things out up there. And so shortly after that, he wrote the letter to the Galatians to explain to them basically what the church had determined as the elders and apostles met. Then he went on his second missionary journey into Thessalonica and the Macedonian Peninsula, that part that's, if you see the Asia Minor sticking out into the Mediterranean here, there's a piece over here that's Macedonia, and it goes down and to a bottleneck and then spreads out. And that was where the Greek Empire had its foundations. And so Thessalonica was a part of that area of the world, and God had sent Paul there. Because on that second missionary journey, Paul intended to stay in Asia Minor and to go into some of the cities there, and the Holy Spirit just wouldn't let him. So he had this vision. You've heard of the Macedonian call. The vision, in the vision, there was a man from Macedonia who called for Paul to come over and help him. And he took that as the direction of the Spirit, and so that's where they went. And you all know the stories about how he went to Philippi and got thrown in jail, and the Philippian jailer and that. Well, the Thessalonians were the next place he went, Thessalonica. So he wrote these two letters probably in 51 or 52. So it was just a couple, 3 years after that church council that they'd had in Jerusalem. And some of the things that are involved in what he says to them create a little bit of a puzzle. So this evening, what I would like to do is to look at the introductory issues that have to do with these two letters. Paul doesn't say as plainly as John does how absolutely critical having the right hope, believing in the rapture and are being gathered together to Jesus. John said in 1 John that if we have this hope fixed upon Him, we will purify ourselves even as He is pure. Which means that if our hope is fixed and locked in, it provides us with motivation to make sure that our life is still connecting with God every day, and we're walking in His light and being instructed by Him and led by His Spirit into a healthy spiritual experience. And so I think it's almost automatic that we can see how the hope has pretty much died in Christendom, and people's lives show it. They're just pretty lackadaisical about their Christianity. And, of course, in our country, we're seeing a huge amount of departure from truth, even among those who claim to be believers. So this matter of the believer's hope, and that's what 1 and 2 Thessalonians is about, is a critical issue. Because I think we mentioned one time in one of our studies the story that Jesus told about the guy that was going to go on a long journey, and he gave his chief household servant charge over all the other slaves and told him to take care of business while he was gone, but he didn't tell him when he was coming back. And so in the early time, the servant did his job well because he expected his master to be back shortly. He didn't want to be caught having not done his work well. But the longer the master of the estate tarried, the more casual the guy got. And finally he sank down into being drunk and beating the other servants and all that kind of stuff. And the point of that story, Jesus said, was if you lose sight of your hope and you don't live in this expectancy, it'll have a detrimental effect on the way we live. And everybody intuitively knows that. I mean, if you knew that Jesus was going to come back on a given day at a given hour, you'd be sure in that day and in that hour that you weren't doing something that you knew He'd be displeased with. That's just automatic. That's the way we think. So, as we begin this study, one of the things that we're going to be focusing a little bit on this evening is what Paul said about the Thessalonians at the end of chapter 1. But let's just get into the introductory stuff. If the scholarship is accurate, the general biblical scholarship that's concurrent right now with us, if it's accurate, the book was the second one of Paul's letters, and it was written about 51 A.D. And there are some discussion, debate about some of that, because some of the scholars can't tell where Paul sent the letter to the Galatians, and that has some timing issues involved with this letter, so I don't know that it matters, except my understanding of Paul's letters is the book of Galatians deals with basically the issue of the grace of God and the gospel and the distortion of the gospel by the legalists who were trying to add in human effort in terms of qualifying yourself before God rather than being qualified by the righteousness of Jesus. So Galatians was the clarifying bell ringing of the gospel, the grace of God. And it's the reason he wrote that letter after having had to go to Jerusalem and tell those people up there that they were tolerating a false gospel. The book of Acts in chapter 15 tells us point blankly that when Paul went up to Jerusalem, there was a group in the church leadership who stood up and said, you can't be saved if you're not circumcised and don't commit to following the law of Moses. And that's just deadly heresy. It says in the text that there were certain Jews that believed, that stood up and said, and some people think that believed means that they were genuine believers, and I don't know if they were or not, but I know the text tells me what they believed. There were certain Jews that believed, and they stood up and said what they believed. And they said, if you don't become a Jew by circumcision and obedience to the law, you can't be saved. That's what they believed. So I don't know what that other phrase, I don't know exactly what Luke had in mind there. But Paul called those people, when he wrote Galatians, he called them false brethren. So he didn't believe that their faith was in the truth of the gospel.
Is that before or after they wrote the letter and said, you know, they couldn't meet the image?
That was the conclusion to that particular meeting. It's interesting that when Paul went up there and corrected them, because he wouldn't give an inch, when they stood up and said, you got to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses, Paul probably jumped to his feet and said, over my dead body. And the interesting thing was, when Paul went through the issues and nailed them down, it was Peter and James who were the first to say, Paul's right. And Peter's the guy in Galatians 2 who was acting the hypocrite by acting like you had to be a Jew in order to be saved. And it was certain disciples that had spun off of some of James's teaching that were actually corrupting the gospel in Antioch. So those two guys felt apparently very convicted that they needed to be precise in their understanding of the gospel. And they stood up and that's when they wrote that letter.
Was that circumcision or the baptism?
No. Circumcision was given to Abraham as a sign of God's covenant to him. And all of his household were to be circumcised. And that was the link to that Abrahamic covenant. Water baptism for the believer is not a link to the covenant. The sign of our covenant is the Lord's table. So we take part in the Lord's table as a commitment to our loyalty to our covenant that we live under, the new covenant. And that's the reason that circumcision is not forced upon the church. And those that want to force it on are just proving that they're being very legal. Now, in our studies of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, I'm going to say what I've always said in the past again, and that is this. If I say something that you don't understand or even if you don't agree with it or you want to ask a question, that's the time to do it. I am not committed to going over a certain amount of material. I am committed to our being able to think together. And as long as there's questions that are not being answered, we're not thinking together. So, like when Nelson asked that question, that's the way I want this time of study to go. And it'll slow our pace down, but who cares? What we need to get is the content of the truth so that we can believe it and walk with the Lord. All right. As the second of Paul's letters, the fact that he addressed some of the particulars of the coming of the Son from heaven, and that's chapter 1, the last verse, verse 10, that's significant. In his statements about the church in Thessalonica, he has a lot of good things to say, but he said in verse 9 that the people who were witnessing the transformation of the people in Thessalonica, they themselves report about us what kind of reception we had with you and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God and to wait for a Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead. That is Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. So the issue here is that there is a twofold thrust in what he considered their witness, and that was they turned to a living God from idols who were not living to serve this living and true God, and they were fixed on waiting for Jesus from heaven. And of course, there's always that tension that comes along when we say, well, you know, we've been waiting for 2,000 years. That always is kind of humming in the background somewhere. But you have to keep in mind, there's a text in at the end of the book of the Revelation. Let me see if I can. I didn't intend to say this, but that's where my mind's going. So it says in chapter 22, verse 7, which is after the formation of the new heaven and the new earth. He says, behold, I come quickly. But he's just got through telling us in chapter 20, or maybe it's in 21. No, it's in chapter 20, that there's going to be 1,000 years between the second coming of Jesus and the final destruction of this world and the great white throne judgment. And this statement is after that, and it says, "Behold, I come quickly." So, we have to keep what Peter said in 2 Peter clearly in mind, that when God declares time, a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. Now, the day as 1,000 years, we all related to when we were kids, because that meant Christmas was going to take forever to get here. That's a day as 1,000 years. But on the other hand, 1,000 years is as a day compresses this whole thing down to a time frame that we can't live with in our own actual living. We're going to live 70, 80, 90 years if we have that opportunity. And most of us are getting close to that if we're not already there or past it. But 70 years is the length of your life. James says it's a puff of smoke. And it's here and gone. Well, for people that are in that kind of a setting, waiting 1,000 years is it's a long, long time. So you have to, when he says, "I come quickly," he's talking about from his perspective. And as far as he's concerned, it's only been 6 days since he created the world. 6,000 years. And so we may be right on the cusp of the beginning of that seventh day, which would be the sabbatical, which is the Messiah's kingdom. But who knows? I mean, I'm just pointing this out, that "I come quickly" doesn't mean like today or tomorrow. But it does mean that you're supposed to, that we're supposed to anticipate that it could be today or tomorrow. It's that lack of anticipation that's the killer. If we let the naysayers have their way and they say, "Well, we've been waiting 2,000 years, he hadn't come yet." If we let that trickle down into the way we're thinking, we're going to make bad choices and do stuff we ought not to do. It's just the way it works. So,
Is that the intent of the parable Jesus told about the virgins and the lamb?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that parable, they actually have a very imminent thing. But some of them didn't have enough oil in their lamps, and they ran out. And I've often wondered, how come those other ones that had oil didn't share? I'm not going there, but I have wondered. I thought it was a Christian thing to do, to share. Anyway, this issue of waiting for his son from heaven, in chapter 4, starting in verse 13 through 18, we actually have the paragraph in this book that addresses specifically the promise of the coming of the Lord from heaven for us. It's the one that we've used a couple of times in relation to funerals and Paul saying, comfort one another with these words, that we're going to one day hear the trumpet and the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God's going to sound, and then Jesus is going to descend and catch us up. And that's in chapter 4. So that's the paragraph that Paul is actually leading up to when he talks about waiting for his son from heaven. But I want you to notice what he says there in the beginning of that paragraph. Starting in verse 13 of chapter 4, he says, "We don't want you to be uninformed." Or if your translation says ignorant, that's not a negative. Everybody's ignorant, okay? When knowledge is infinite, everybody's ignorant. Ignorance only means that you haven't been exposed to the stuff. If somebody else has been, well, then they're not ignorant and you are, but that's not a plus on their part. They didn't have anything to do with how they were exposed to it and that kind of thing. But the point is, this rapture truth was not widely taught, because he's teaching it here. And he says, "I don't want you to be uninformed about these truths." Well, that implies that the vast majority of the people are uninformed until he writes this. So that signals that there's a block of truth that we call the rapture truth that has not been widely disseminated, and it's just beginning to be disseminated by Paul at this point. And that brings up the reality of what we call progressive revelation. There's nothing about the rapture in the Old Testament. There's nothing about the rapture in the ministry of Jesus on the planet. except there's an oblique reference to it in John 14 when he says, if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself. He's talking there about the rapture, but it's not obvious from chapter 14. He's just, it's real general. I'm going to prepare a place for you and I'll come get you when it's implication when it's ready. So Matthew 24, where it talks about two in the bed and one's taken, one's left, that's not rapture truth. The 24th chapter of Matthew is about the disaster called the Great Tribulation. And at the end of it, there's going to be, when Jesus comes, there's going to be a fulfillment of his statement to Nicodemus. He said, if you're not born again, you're not going to see it. If you're not born again, you're not going to enter it. He's talking about the kingdom. Well, how's he going to get rid of those that are still alive just before he's going to set up his kingdom who have not believed? Well, there'll be two in the bed and one will be out and the other will remain. The one that goes is the one who's being dismissed from life. They're going into outer darkness. So, anyway, the mystery of this lack of preaching on the rapture by Paul is deepened when he says, if in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians, which he turned right around and wrote within just a little while, in chapter 2, it says in verse 1 of chapter 2, we request you, brethren, with regard to the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him. Now that's the rapture. Okay? That ye not be quickly shaken from your composure or disturbed either by spirit or message or letter as from us to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Now the day of the Lord is not the rapture. The day of the Lord is a phrase in the Old Testament that had a dark period followed by a light period, because that's what a day was. They started in the evening at sunset, and they went through the darkness. And in the dawn, you had the period of day, and when it come back to evening, that was day one. So the day started in the evening. And so the format of a day was, it starts with darkness, and it ends with light. Well, in the Old Testament, the day of the Lord was presented in two different ways. In one of the ways, it was a brilliant, light-filled kingdom of ecstatic joy and, you know, the messianic kingdom on earth and all of that. And so some of them were saying, oh, we want the day of the Lord to come. And the prophet said, be careful what you ask for, because the day of the Lord is going to be a day of darkness and disaster and trouble and all kinds of stuff. And so if you were asking for the day of the Lord to come, you were asking for the day of trouble to come, because the darkness is going to be the tribulation period and the light's going to be the kingdom period. So there's two different issues in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. One of them is the Jesus coming for us, and then the issue of the day of the Lord, because Paul taught, whether you believe it or not, a pre-tribulational rapture, which meant the rapture was going to happen before the day of the Lord started. So if they were being taught that the day of the Lord had already started, that meant one of two things. Either they hadn't gone into rapture, or that they'd been mistaught. And he says it's even suggested that there might have been a letter, a false letter, that was written and signed by somebody and called it a letter from Paul. But anyway, he says in verse 3, don't let anybody deceive you. It's not going to come until. And then you have this word apostasy, but there's no apostasy in 1 and 2 Thessalonians. That word means the departure. So he's saying the day of the Lord is not going to come until the departure comes first. And then also the man of sin or lawlessness is going to be revealed before the day of the Lord actually gets into its terrible dark period. And so what he's saying is he's clarifying these things about the rapture and the day of the Lord and that. And he says in verse 5, do you not remember that while I was with you, I was telling you these things? That's chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. Yeah, I was, but I shifted.
I
2 Thessalonians 2, 5. The issue of verse 5 is the statement that Paul said, don't you remember when I was with you, I was telling you this stuff? Well, we don't know how much of the stuff that he's just outlined he had already taught them. But keep this in mind. When we look at the time when Paul wrote this letter, these things of verse 5 of 2 Thessalonians 2 are the details that reveal certain facts concerning the coming of the Son from heaven, which is a general theme because we know the rapture is the coming from heaven and the second coming when Jesus actually comes at the end of the tribulation to establish his kingdom is also a coming. So the second coming is often presented as having two phases. The rapture phase when he comes for the church, and then the kingdom phase when he comes to set up his kingdom. But it says here that there are certain things that have to happen first, and those things, apparently at least in some way, didn't include chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians, verses 13 through 18, because when he wrote that, he said, I didn't get to this when I was with you. I don't want you to be uninformed. This is going to happen, but I didn't have the opportunity to tell you that when I was with you. And the reason is because, according to Acts 17, verses 1 to 9, when Paul went to the city of Thessalonica, it says he was there for 3 Sabbaths before they ran him out of town. So, maximum of 4 weeks, 3 Sabbaths could include, you know, Sunday through till the first Sabbath, and then another Sabbath, and then another Sabbath, and then the third Sabbath, and then another week. So it could be five weeks maximum. What I'm saying here is that obviously Paul, according to Acts 17, wasn't there long enough to tell them much. And even if he was preaching all night like he did in one place, they weren't retaining it. You can't expect people to sit and listen for hours and hours and hours and expect them to retain it. That's probably why the board gives me 30 minutes on Sunday morning, because if I go longer than that, I'm not going to retain it anyway. I'm just teasing. In the record of Acts regarding the Corinthian situation, Acts 18, verse 11, Paul was in Corinth for 18 months in comparison to being in Thessalonica for 3 Sabbaths. Okay? Now I want you to notice what 1 Corinthians 15:51 says. 1 Corinthians 15:51. Now these letters were written later because Paul hadn't even been to Corinth when he went to Thessalonica. So in the end of close to the end of the letter, 1 Corinthians, in chapter 15, in verse 51, he says this, behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised, unperishable, and we shall be changed. And this perishable must put on the imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. Well, he's talking right there about the rapture. Because he says we're going to all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. In 1 Thessalonians 4, he said that those of us who are alive and remain will suddenly be caught up to be with the Lord after he's raised the dead. So in 1 Thessalonians, the trumpet's going to sound and the dead are going to be raised and immortalized. And then the trumpet's going to sound again, the last trump. And when that sounds, the church that's alive, the people who are alive and remain, as Paul's words in 1 Thessalonians, will be caught up together with them. Well, that's what he's saying in verse 52 of 1 Corinthians 15. But notice what he says at the beginning in verse 51. This is a mystery. So, I say these things to prime the pump because, according to Paul and Luke's record of Paul's ministry in Acts, he was in Thessalonica for 3 Sabbaths before they ran him out of town. And yet, in in 2 Thessalonians, he says, when I was with you, I told you about the man of sin and some of this stuff. He said, don't you remember when I was with you, I was telling you this? So in 3 weeks or 4 weeks or however long it was, he did manage to get some of this prophetic stuff. He taught them, but they didn't apparently get the rapture truth because he told them in 1 Thessalonians that he didn't want them to be uninformed, so that means he hadn't covered that. Well, when he spent 18 months in Corinth, he didn't get around to that according to this verse, because in verse 51 of 1 Corinthians 15, it's a mystery, and that means it hadn't been revealed. I didn't tell you this. I would like to have Paul's notes on how to start a church in a town. What's the preaching order? What do you cover? You know, the preaching, the sermon outline setup, what the day one or first message is going to be on this, the next one's going to be on this. And if you're there for 3 weeks, you just get this far. And if you're there 18 months, you get this far. And if you stay in the same place for your whole lifetime, well, then you might get this far. All I'm saying is, Paul is clear on this issue of they were waiting for the Son from heaven, but the details of the wait were up in there, because he didn't go into the details until he wrote the letter. You know, he goes to Athens from Thessalonica, and then he runs into these philosophers. But he would have stayed with the Thessalonians longer, but the town ran him out. They had to send him away because there was such an uproar in Thessalonica, if you read Acts 17.
Is that where they were losing money with their idols and all that?
No, that was Ephesus. That was a different setting. But when Paul went to Philippi, he preached and he got thrown in jail and beat up by the citizens, the leaders of the town. They threw him in jail. Well, the next day they sent and told Paul he could leave, just leave. And he said, I'm not leaving. They threw me as a Roman citizen into jail, and I'm not leaving until they come and apologize. And when they found out he was a Roman citizen and they'd thrown him in jail without a proper trial, they knew they were in a pinch. And so he wasn't above saying, no, y'all come tell me. But anyway, when he went to Thessalonica, he started having this great impact within the first week. Well, the people from Philippi come up there and start stirring up trouble. So that's why they had to kick him out. The brethren had to send him off because it was getting to be a very threatening situation.
Oh, it was for his own protection?
Yeah.
Not because they were mad.
No, the point is that in these two letters, we're going to be focusing on details that he didn't tell them until he wrote the letters. And he didn't even apparently get into the details for the Corinthians in 18 months. So I don't know what all was going on, and I don't know what he... Well, take the book of Romans just for an example. That's the book that lays out the doctrine of the gospel of God. It's the comprehensive thing. Where's the rapture in it? So we can actively anticipate the coming of the Son from heaven, but we're not going to be anticipating it like we would if we knew that it was a rapture reality, and that's what was happening in Thessalonica. They were looking for the Son to come from heaven, but they were looking for him to come set up his kingdom, not to come and make them immortal and raise them from the dead and that kind of thing.
Is there anywhere where we're told where Paul got this information?
Paul's own testimony was that when he was converted, he went out into the desert and he was personally instructed by Jesus himself. He didn't get his gospel from a man. He got it from Christ. And so I'm assuming on the basis of that as the initial way for him to get the doctrine squared away in his own head, that he was also receiving revelation from the Lord along the way, because this is new information. In fact, Paul might not have even known about the rapture in the early stages of it. Okay? Let's have a word of prayer, and y'all that are musicians can go music.